A task force on open government says the city of Jacksonville needs to be more transparent. Good morning and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Charlene Shirk in for Melissa Ross. We're always live at 9, and of course, make sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Well, just ahead, we're going to speak with the co-chairs of the Jacksonville Task Force on Open Government and find out what needs to be done to provide the media and the public more access to our local government. The number to call is 549-2937. Then later, our latest segment of Movable Feast celebrates the fifth anniversary of the Women's Food Alliance. Plus, the First Coast Connect Book Club commemorates the 20th anniversary of the Harry Potter series. Can you believe it? It's been 20 years. All of that and more. But first this hour, it was a major issue for former City Council President Ana Lopez Broche. Make the government of the city of Jacksonville just easier to deal with. So she formed the Task Force on Open Government. Well, they finished their task just before her term wrapped up at the end of June. And the results, not so great news for media and residents who are trying to get information from the Curry administration and other city officials. The panel's first final report, says city government makes it difficult for the public to understand the governmental process and just how decisions are made. It also said it is too hard to find information on the city's website and to communicate with city officials. So to talk about the findings of the task force, we are now joined by its co-chairs, local attorney Hank Cox, and the former head of the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund, Sherry McGill. Thanks so much for being here this morning.
Thank you, Charlene.
We are going to have a very interesting conversation, so we want to make sure our callers have our number. And we want to pose the question to you, what do you believe the city of Jacksonville needs to do to make its government more open to the public and the media? Have you ever tried to get information? Have you ever tried to get a hold of somebody at City Hall about a problem? Well, the number to call today for us is 549-2937. So I can't help but note that, you know, ironically, the city of Jacksonville's relatively new slogan, "It's easier here," clearly does not appear to extend to navigating local government or getting real information from it, according to the results of this report. So I want to start with the why. I think so often we miss that question, and it's the most important question at the end of the day. Why was this task force formed to begin with?
Let me begin, Charlene, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here with Sherry. The charge from the city council was specifically to make recommendations how the city of Jacksonville could be more open and accessible to the public and can institutionalize transparency. I met with President Broche beforehand when she asked me to do this, and I don't think I had met her twice in my life before she asked me. So I was flattered to do it. But by the same token, I can say there were no hidden agendas in what she asked us to do. It was, how can the citizens of Jacksonville best access information from their government? And in your opening remarks, you mentioned the administration. The task force didn't single out the administration. The task force addressed the administration, the council. We took information at length from the sheriff's office and the state attorney's office, two other agencies that deal with public interest in their records and information also.
So, Hank, when you say that, do you mean if I want to get information from the sheriff's office, if I want to get information from the state attorney's office as a whole, how accessible is that information? And are the officials in charge of those, say, departments?
We didn't reach conclusions about the sheriff's office. We took a lot of information from them. We took a lot of information from the state attorney's office. We didn't form any conclusions about them. We talked to the state attorney's office because the media had said that in their judgment, the state attorney's office was making a tremendous effort toward improving public access to their records. So we were interested in how they were making that improvement, what they were doing to do it. The sheriff's office we listened to because they probably are the single greatest institution in our city where public has an interest in their records.
Yeah. And what I would add, Charlene, is if you read the charge to the task force, there is this value statement about healthy democratic society. It's not just openness and transparency, but it's also public engagement. So we spent part of our time talking about listening to people like CPACs, for example, explain their relationship with local government. So, you know, it was a quick study. We only met for 10 weeks. It was a very compressed time. We listened to 23 presentations. So it ranged from definition of public records, how easy it is for folks to access those, to the website, to CPACs, to a general understanding about basic democratic values and whether or not we're practicing those locally and how well we're practicing those.
What was the representation on the task force? I know you want to get a variety of backgrounds so that you have a variety of experiences and a variety of approaches. So can you walk us through a little bit the complexion and who made up this task force?
Well, in addition to Hank, a well-known lawyer, and me, who headed a private foundation for a number of years, we had someone who's from the represents the city's Ethics Commission, the Public Education Fund, two former members of City Council, a well-known former columnist with the Times Union who's covered local government for over 20 years, a young lawyer with the Bedell Law Firm, a former chief of staff to a former mayor, someone with the Florida Nonprofit Alliance, and someone on the board of the FSCJ.
Mm-hmm. And let me ask you this. When you got together and you've got kind of this brain trust, did it ever get heated? Did it ever get, you've got someone from a previous administration saying, well, this is not how we did it and we did it better, which also then kind of, it begs the question, was any of the previous administrations, was there ever a similar investigation? I don't want to call it investigation because it really wasn't. It was more of an inquiry into how the government is accessing, allowing the public to access records and information. Is there ever been this done in the history of previous administrations?
I think it's fair to say you're dealing with human beings, so you're dealing with opinions and their prior experiences. Certainly we had, for example, a member of the task force who had a lot of prior experience with CPACs. These are the groups that meet. There are six of them in the city. And had strong feelings about how they used to operate versus how they may be operating now. So we had the benefit of that, but by the same token, people can measure the value of what they're hearing and say, okay, we've heard from CPACs now, we've heard from how it used to be. We can make our collective judgment about the entire process and how it could improve if we thought it should.
It was never heated. Mm-hmm. There were disagreements. We worked very hard to reach consensus about what we heard, but it was a very civil, thoughtful process.
Can I just add to that? I think that's a large measure attributable to the fact that I didn't sense that anyone had an agenda sitting on this task force. That could have caused problems if it would have been for somebody, against somebody, for this entity, mm-hmm. against that entity. That's where problems could have arisen.
Well, and I'm glad you bring that up, Hank, because one of the reasons that I wanted to ask the why is because it's been no secret that the former city council president has had some issues with the Curry administration, particularly over the JEA issue. And I believe the terminology was the Curry administration was creating a threatening environment when trying to get information about what clearly became a very polarizing issue in this community. So how often, if any, did that topic come up?
We didn't talk about JEA. We talked about city council processes, administrative processes. We met with a variety of people. The journalism panel was fascinating. They helped us understand their frustrations with their public records requests. We heard from not very many, but a couple of members of the public consistent came to every meeting who talked about the problem with city council committees and subcommittees and being able to speak before city council. And, you know, there is a public comment portion of most meetings, and what we learned from them was a lot of inconsistency.
Now, we've got two callers on the line, and they're both it looks like their topics that they both want to discuss have to do with the police department not making documents accessible, the fees for that. Was that covered? I'd love to grab one of these calls, but if that's not, well, if it doesn't, even something you even addressed.
Well, Sherry, if you wanted to go first, but I'll say we had a lot of information from the people in charge of the production of public records from the sheriff's office.
Let me bring Tom on the line.
Sure.
Let me bring Tom on the line. All right, Tom, are you on the line right now?
Yes, ma'am, I am.
All right, Tom's on the west side. Tom, you wanted to talk a little bit about access to police documents as well as some of the fees that it costs to try to get some of these documents. Can you share your concerns?
Yes, because I've heard many mentions of just exorbitant cost when the people have requested records, especially the media, and just been faced with costs that are truly outrageous and something that's not sustainable to a small publication like Folio. And I also mentioned earlier that when the police took away the radios from the media, I noticed that coverage declined quite a bit. I have a hard time finding out what's going on in my neighborhood now.
All right, Tom, did you have one of those radios that you could listen to the police transmissions?
No, I didn't. But you know, I relied on the media, and I think I got way better coverage of what was going on through the media when the media still had access to the radios and could follow up on stories without having to, you know, rely on the police briefer to tell them what was going on.
All right, Tom, thank you so much for that call. And I can weigh in just real quick, you know, being a journalist in this town for over 20 years, sitting in a newsroom, and I started on the assignment desk, and my job was to listen to that police radio and know all the numbers of the scanners. And we would send a crew out if we thought something could be something. Sometimes, you know, you don't get a lot of the detailed information. And then we decided if this was newsworthy or not, versus depending on now a police public information officer communicating to us when they felt there was a story worthy of news coverage or that they needed to let us know.
Let me just go back to the cost, because that's what we focused on. And our finding number 12 in the task force report, and I'll quote, "The cost of producing public records varies." We didn't make any findings about the sheriff's office, so let me just speak personally from what we heard and my own judgment about that. Nobody more than the sheriff's office can produce varying costs. They told us that they would use the highest paid detective, or let's say the highest paid, $48 an hour to a detective, pulling him away from his homicide duties to collect information from homicide cases that are requested in public records.
They don't have an administration person who can do that?
Well, I'm not going to sit here and suggest how they might want to revisit how they collect records. But when you talk about a citizen asking for records that are mm-hmm. public and then being told, well, here's what it's going to cost, and included that cost is $48 an hour just to collect the records. That has nothing to do with going through the records to determine what is not publicly available. And that's, we reached that conclusion just based between the city council and the administration on varying costs of production. So the sheriff's office takes it to the far end of the spectrum, I think. I don't know if Sherry yeah. agrees with that.
No, I do. And they all use redaction software. Mm-hmm. But I think they have very...
Wait, they use software now? Because back in my day, they just took a black marker and marked everything out.
And they mark it out.
The state attorney, the sheriff, mm-hmm. They particularly use redaction software. Mm-hmm. Now, we could make no judgments about how good that software is. It sounds like, Charlene, an individual or a group of individuals goes behind the redaction software to make sure that everything that is private and deemed private is redacted from the document. So depending on what's requested, it can take hours, and the cost really is dependent upon what kind of personnel are used, how much time it takes. It seems to be an opportunity with technology to really look at what others are doing and how they're driving down costs and how effective and efficient they can be in responding to requests.
Let me add another example to what Sherry's talking about. The nature of public records changes over time. The law doesn't change. What is a public record is defined as whatever relates to the government business, et cetera. But we're in a universe of text messages now.
Mm-hmm.
Text messages, if it relates to government business, are public record. Yet text messages have become a very complicated or complex item to recover in response to a public records request. If I text from my personal phone and I'm working for the government, it's still a public record, no matter who I'm texting to. So how do you recover all the text messages? And people have systems or phone systems that don't even save text messages. So it's I say in the defense of a lot of government agencies, they're confronted with that issue. It's a very expensive problem.
But to respond to Tom's question, the experience we heard was that the cost varies across mm-hmm. entity. And the amount of time varies across entity and the type of redaction software varies across. So I think, you know, we're seeking some kind of uniformity in how local entities respond to public records requests.
I guess by putting my media hat on, like, you can make it as accessible or inaccessible as you'd like, and you can use all types of reasons how you are allowing access to that information.
I think that's fair.
Yeah. And everyone we talked to is very, very proud of their own websites.
Let's talk about the website, because that was one of your findings, is that the website was not easy to navigate. Information wasn't easy to find, as well as, which was ironic, because your report is very easy to find on the website right now. So let's talk a little bit about that, because when it does come to websites, sometimes that can be a budget issue, you know, whether you've got somebody who's updating it, the SEO, the navigational tools, that's not cheap. Content, you know, it depends if there's somebody dedicated there to write it and update it. I mean, that is pretty much a full-time job of a department, not just really one person. So what were your findings as you had concerns and complaints, but as you went and talked to the folks who really are in charge of managing that aspect of communication?
I would say two things. We did not have enough time, given the compressed time of this work, to delve deeply into cost. So I don't think we can speak to how much it would cost to do a better job with the website. We did see a fabulous presentation, and it's in the appendices, by a man named Greg Bugby with Novus Insight, and he has built websites for cities. The data side of it, Charlene, he walked us through an exercise. He's new to Jacksonville, been here about 2 years, around trash collection. And he showed examples from other cities where it's very simple to be a new citizen and learn how this works. And then he showed us our website. So there are two parts of this. There's the data information. It might be crime reports. It might be trash collection. It might be when CPACs meet. That is very different from understanding policy and legislation. And so he kind of sees two buckets, and our website hasn't been developed that way, so that the user experience isn't citizen-centric on the data side. And it was very compelling to us when we saw these other examples, and they're referenced in the report. People can go to the report, click on some of those other city sites, and see what we're talking about there. But I don't think we can address the question about cost, because we couldn't delve into it.
I want to grab Mike from Arlington. Are you there? Mike from Arlington, are you there? I don't have Mike from Arlington yet. He wants to talk a little bit about the public information is not public. He thinks that more should be done. Kevin's coming in here to help me with the board again. Okay. Press the button, Kevin.
Can you hear me?
All right. Yeah, Mike, hello. Thanks so much for your patience. I appreciate it. Go ahead and share, folks, what your concern is.
Are you hearing me?
I can hear you.
Okay, great, great. I'm a former journalist, and this is just a way for institutions to try to blunt accountability. It's this should. I realize the cost issues that are supposedly put forth, but the reality is that these institutions should be tracking this information themselves. They should be. These are the kind of things that our institutions should be aware of and should be tracking and should be studying, and that information should be available to the public. And if they're not tracking it and by turn making that information available to the public, then that says a lot about how our institutions are policing themselves. It's just a bogus argument, I think. The cost is, I'm not saying that it doesn't cost things, but cost has become a big red herring now. It's everybody claims, oh, cost, it costs too much, it costs too much. That is just it's a phony argument. This is information, it's data, it's how the world works, and making it public is how this institutions remain accountable, and the press is the conduit through which all that happens. Thanks, Nala. Let's not be here.
Hey, thanks so much, Mike. Well, and that's why I wanted to ask you, is it a budget issue? Are we not getting the money in the door to get the data centralized and in a computer so that you're not going through paper files? You can actually look up, do some kind of analytics, get the data, and have it be more easily processed internally so that it could be more effectively provided externally.
Yeah, I think what Mike is suggesting is that cost, no matter what it is, becomes an excuse for not prioritizing the public's access to the public's business. And I think it's a very serious question. I think it's the rationale for the task force work. And one of our recommendations, is that periodically city council appoint a task force to see how well we're doing. Do we really prioritize the public's engagement in local government? Do we genuinely prioritize the public's access to the public's business?
So can I ask a question?
Regardless of cost.
Is this, when Mike said it's a red herring, it's a way to prevent and be able to pick and choose, or is it a lack of competence? Is it a lack of accountability? Is it just not a priority? I mean, what is at the crux of, again, I say the why?
I don't suggest it's a lack of competence, because we heard from very competent people. The issue is what data and information are they putting out? I said that everybody's individually proud of their websites. My law firm is proud of its website. But we're putting out, just like these agencies are doing, information that they want to put out. They're not making the decision, what does the public most want, or what are all the things that the public would want? They are telling the public, here's what we're going to give you.
Hank, is that because they think this is what the public wants, or this is, to your point, is it because this is what they want to put out? Because sometimes there's a miscommunication between what we think the community wants and what the community really wants.
Well, let me give a related issue or explanation of that we dealt with, and that was access to government or administration department heads, et cetera. And the point we made, or what we heard, was that they are not, as a matter of policy, encouraged or even allowed to discuss with the press certain issues that the press wants to talk to the head of this agency about, the head of that agency about. It's funneled to a public information person. Same true with the sheriff's office. They funnel it to public information officers. The media is not going to be able to talk to the sergeant out there. They're going to get it through the public information officer. And so it was what we heard so often, the term messaging. Mm-hmm. So that's what websites are doing. They're messaging a lot of this information. One of the findings we made is that the city council no longer puts a lot of emails or council member emails on their website. Well, why not? It's not hard. It's not a cost issue. They can put everything else up there. They can put the emails up there. So I defer to Sharon.
And nobody whom we heard from puts text messages on the website. So we all know that a lot of business happens through texting, as Hank said a few minutes ago. That's simply not available. That conversation is simply not available.
So let me ask you this. What now? What now? Now that we have this information, what are the next steps? Is there, you met with some folks to come to these, to do the investigation, to come to the conclusions. What happens with this now?
Well, I'll defer to Sherry in a moment, but we had invited current president, city council president Bowman, to attend. He didn't attend. We invited his successor to attend. They didn't attend. And we heard scheduling conflicts or whatever. But I read, and I haven't talked to him, I read afterwards that President Bowman went ahead and adopted a couple of the recommendations that were made. May not have agreed with everything. I don't know. As I said, I haven't spoken to him. But I would think a number of things, one of which we heard from the Attorney General's office, Pat Gleason, who is unbelievable and is the institution in Florida on public records. And it wouldn't hurt anybody if Pat Gleason made a return visit every year for the administration and the city council and some of these other agencies to share her thoughts about this process.
Well, and I would add to that, not just Ms. Gleason, but the city's ethics director. We heard from her over many meetings and almost an appeal from her about how important this is. How important it is to be diligent in demanding that government be responsive and open and transparent with the people is a critical concern. And I found her argument very compelling. So diligence by the people's representatives, that is city council, making it absolutely possible that this kind of task force meets episodically to really take stock. How well are we doing? Is this a priority for us as a people?
Now we have Einar on the line who's been holding from Arlington. Einar, are you there?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for taking my call.
So I think where Einar wants to lead with is there an opportunity to do some type of report on other agencies in the community? Einar, is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, my wife's uncle just got shot 8 times in his front porch, mentally ill person, overweight, he could barely walk. And we have a police release that claims that he was charging an officer 6 feet away. I mean, the man was well known to the police. And his family worked with the police every time to take him to the hospital because it was way too large. And when he had an episode, he needed help.
And I know they've had several press briefings about this particular case. So is your concern, though, that, again, to what our folks have been saying, is that they're presenting the information they want to present, but as a family member and a friend, the real data that you're looking for is not being easily accessed?
Absolutely. Yes, it just is impossible to get through the red tape.
Charlene, wait.
Hank, jump in here.
Yeah, I want to make an observation, not to mix apples and oranges. Access to representatives of the government and asking questions and listening to what they have to say and what explanations they have is a different animal than access to public records. And sometimes, as the caller would suggest, patience is key, and it's patience waiting for the conclusion or completion of something and then accessing the public records that exist to support that, not what people say publicly, et cetera. And that's what you have to wait for sometimes. The transparency in public records law in Florida has actually produced the greatest results in terms of public understanding of what actually happened. It may not be their understanding at the moment it happens, but eventually they're going to learn from the records.
Einar, thanks so much for your call. And again, we're so sorry to hear about your family tragedy, and we hope you get the information that you're looking for to bring you some closure to this.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Well, and I think that's what, to your point, Hank, what can the average citizen do? I mean, if you're, and it doesn't have to be something as obviously as large and traumatic and impactful as the death of a family member, but just like you said, trying to find your trash pickup or trying to call and find out, you know, if you want to report something. I know there's a lot of, when I was in Leadership Jacksonville, I wrote out with the guys who do the enforcement of some of the code enforcements, and you've got a house next door that you want to report, that you want to get into the system, and trying to find a real person to talk to. I think that's one of the things that I think is the priority focus of this report, is that for the average citizen, media is always going to have their beef that they're not getting the information that they want and they need. But for the average citizen who's either trying to make their community a better place by being an engaged and active citizen, or has a problem within their own situation, how do they become part of the process and part of the solution? I think people get so frustrated at the end of the day that they just give up.
Well, I think there is no substitute for people having a relationship with their elected representatives. If you do not know who represents your district, or you do not know who the at-large representatives are, it's incumbent upon you to learn that. You'll have to use the website to learn it, but show up. Otherwise, this is a farce in terms of democratic government.
And Charlene, let me say, and I understand and sympathetic to Einar's situation, but the reality is it's the tens of thousands of people who want to know, where can I find out how much longer that street's going to be torn up in mm-hmm. front of my house?
Right.
What about the trash pickup issues that Sherry's talking about? What about the planning and zoning meetings? I see these signs pop up in neighborhoods. I got to stop and block traffic to read the print on it. But where can I go just to find out what's coming? That's simple. That's what the average person out there is interested in. And so it's the ease with which you get the information. And I think Sherry would agree that the task force focused to a great extent not on that anybody's breaking the law. There's no suggestion anybody isn't complying with the public records law. It's the ease with which the citizens ought to be able to access information if the government has it. Why? What's the easiest way they can make it available to the public?
I think that's a great spot to end on. By Sherry, you providing that, at the end of the day, you can have all the websites you want, but it's really a personal relationship you have with the person who represents your part of your community. And Hank, then it's following, being able to get the information that you need to become an active person. I know I live out at the beaches, and we're three little tiny communities. And believe me, you know everybody who represents you because you see them on the street and you see the signs and everybody knows everything. We have our little unofficial mayors of our streets and our blocks and in our community. Unfortunately, when your city gets larger, you tend to lose that intimacy and that personal interaction. But I think that's a very important point to make. I want to thank you both so much for all the time and effort that you put in to co-chairing this panel. Trial lawyer Hank Cox and former Jesse Ball DuPont Center head Sherry McGill for their time and effort. And you're the kind of folks who help make our community a better place to live.
Thank you.
All right. Well, we have got much more still ahead. Later, the musical Newsies is coming to the Ponte Vedra Concert Hall. Great venue to see, a place you do not want to miss it. You're going to hear all about it. But up next, it's the fifth anniversary of the Women's Food Alliance, our latest segment of Movable Feast. Stay with us, everybody. First Coast Connect will be back in just a moment.
Is your American Graduate Champion. WJCT is looking to recognize and honor a wide range of community leaders and everyday heroes who regularly dedicate their time, talent, and resources to prepare students for success and graduation. American Graduate Champions are role models in their communities whose stories have the potential to inspire others to take action. The nomination deadline is September 1st, 2018. Go to WJCT.org to nominate your American Graduate Champion today.
Can a song really cause a wave of suicides?
Supposedly, when they played it on the radio, people committed suicide after listening to it, so it was banned.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, we'll uncover data about suicide. Can it be contagious?
Sunday afternoon at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday nights at 9 for Turntable Tuesday, only at the Electro Lounge on 89.9. Your community, your world, your music.
Welcome back, everybody. It's an organization bringing women in the culinary industry together across North Florida and Georgia. In today's Movable Feast, our look at dining trends around town, Lee Court, who heads the Women's Food Alliance, talks with its leaders.
Have a banana, Hannah.
First this morning, good morning, Cindy Stavely with the Colonial Quarter and the Pirate Museum in St. Augustine.
Good morning, Lee. First of all, I can't believe it's been five wonderful years since we've started. It's been an amazing ride with everybody, all these professional women. And I've learned so much from everybody in the hospitality industry for so many different aspects of our field that we're in. And the food and the beverages that we've enjoyed together have just been a memorable experience. And you, Lee, are an amazing ambassador and leader for all of us women in the hospitality industry here in Northeast Florida. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And we have enjoyed having a few events over the past 5 years at the Colonial Quarter. And thank you for being part of our five-year leadership. Thank you very much. And now next to you is Faye Lance. And Faye has been a member. Actually, the first time we met you, Faye, was at the Colonial Quarter. It was a hot summer night, and you were a new member of the Women's Food Alliance, and you shared with us that you are the sugar snob chocolate gal.
That is correct. I own a company called Sugar Snob Chocolates, where I'm in the process of trying to have bean-to-bar chocolates in Jacksonville.
Wait, say that again. Bean-to-bar. That's rare.
Bean-to-bar chocolates here in Jacksonville. And yes, Colonial was my first time, and I have enjoyed the journey, and I've learned a lot being a part of the Women's Food Alliance with you and all the ladies.
Well, we hope that you have another 5 years with us, at least. Thanks for being with us today, and we look forward to seeing you July 24th.
I will be there.
And sitting in the studio next to Faye is Ms. Barbara Golden, who is sort of the queen of St. John's County and doing publicity for so many aspects of our county, of St. Augustine, Ponte Vedra, the beaches, World Golf Village. So welcome, Barbara Golden.
Thank you, Lee. Boy, how nice to be called the queen. Wow.
You're not
just
the queen
bee.
My children usually refer to me as that. But I tell you, I really enjoy my job. I enjoy representing such a great destination. And I really enjoy being part of this organization.
When you first came to me about the Women's Food Alliance, I was, oh, that sounds so exciting because it involves food. But I will tell you, every single event that I have attended with the Women's Food Alliance, I have experienced an incredible education or fellowship with women in the industry. I have learned so much from how to take the right kinds of pictures of food. I'm looking forward to learning some food etiquette down the road with really raising the level in the bar, and again, doing it with all of these women in the hospitality industry.
And sitting next to you as we go around the table, we have Kathleen Hurley. And Kathleen, oh my gosh, in probably 2001, Kathleen bought and opened the famous Casa de Sueños Bed and Breakfast, another aspect of hospitality here in North Florida. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, how are you, Lee?
I'm just great. Thank you for being with us today.
Great. Great to be here. And I love the Women's Food Alliance. It exposes us every time we get together to so many professional women in the organization that have businesses and run things in Northeast Florida.
Ann Urban has many companies, but today we're going to introduce her as Destination Planning. And you have been with us since the beginning also, Ann, for 5 years. So welcome this morning.
Well, thank you. Good morning. It's an honor to be here. And I actually, my first meeting was the one at your B&B. And I'm a member of a lot of organizations and several in the industry, but I don't know if you remember this or not, Lee. I actually called you. Now, I'm in the event business. I own a company that does and produces over 300 events a year. Every single event that Women's Food Alliance had looked so unique and so amazing that I called you and said, What do I need to do to become a part of this organization?
Because, that's what we all love to hear, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, totally for selfish reasons. I knew that you were having way more fun than I was, and I wanted to be a part of this group.
It's exciting to plan our fifth anniversary. We're going back to where we began 5 years ago. Our first event was at the Casa Marina Hotel in Jacksonville Beach. So how appropriate for us to celebrate our fifth anniversary back at the Casa Marina Hotel. We have a lot of surprises that are going to take place that day, July 24th from 5:30 to 8:30 p.m. And whether you're a member of the Women's Food Alliance or thinking about the Women's Food Alliance, please be in touch with us. Just find us, womensfoodalliance.com, and let us know you want to join us for our fifth anniversary. Thank you, ladies. I love you. Goodbye from Movable Feast.
When they come to my
We'll be back in just a moment.
The First Coast Connect Book Club is sponsored by San Marco Books and More.
Butterfly in the sky, I can go twice as high.
Welcome back, everybody. Can you believe it was 20 years ago when British author J.K. Rowling began telling us the story of young wizard Harry Potter and his friends Hermione Granger and Ron Weasley at the Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry? Well, 7 books, 8 movies later, it is one of the most iconic series of all time that got millions of children to turn off that TV and pick up a book. Well, there's an upcoming anniversary party coming up at San Marco Books and more to talk all about Harry. We are now joined by First Coast Connect Book Club blogger Stacy Goldring and Desiree Bailey, owner of San Marco Books and More. But our question to callers, you get to be part of this conversation. What is your favorite Harry Potter book and how did it impact you and your kids or get your kids interested in reading? Again, the number is 549-2937. Ladies, what a great topic to discuss right now.
I am so excited to discuss Harry Potter. I love Harry Potter. I am from Gryffindor. I don't know about you, Desiree. Are you Gryffindor?
As a matter of fact, I am.
Well, look at that kindred spirits. How about you, Charlene?
Well, no one wants to be Slytherin. I mean, come on.
Although I did hear in the green room, there are some redeeming qualities. I am going to try to get in as many facts as I can, as time will allow, if I can move my...
You got to see, she's in full regale right now. I got to tell you, I remember, though, kids lining up at bookstores
all dressed like you.
Oh, yes. And everybody was so excited. This was the first time in a long, long time where kids were really excited about reading. And reading, like, not just 10 pages.
Oh, no. You know why? Because this woman draws on this writer who is the all-time highest grossing author. She has sold more books than she has all of those accolades behind her. But what she has done is she has managed to draw on every single universal literary theme. So it speaks to everyone on every level. So her language speaks to everyone. So you could get it at any level. There are so many incredible things about the Potter books. For example, we all know who the Dementors are. Mm-hmm. There is a cure for Dementors, and that is the remedy to lighten the effects of a Dementor is chocolate.
That's a good remedy.
Yeah,
remedy
I like
to a lot of things.
And, you know, it is a universal remedy, I believe. Rowling said if she were a teacher at Hogwarts, she would teach charms, and if she had a job in the wizarding world, she would write spell books. Of course, right? She would be an author. Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, dragon blood is revealed to be a great effective oven cleaner. So that's good to know.
Dragon blood.
Yes. Very good to know.
Okay.
Yes. Mm-hmm. When Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban was released in Great Britain, the publisher asked stores not to sell the book until schools were closed for the day to prevent truancy. Did you have kids skipping school in order to come in and buy Potter? You can tell.
We did.
Really? Absolutely.
I mean, we had people that will come in. You know, we had a midnight party. There were people lining up at 9 o'clock at night. There were people in chairs, and we're just one of the small bookstores. So I think that it's something where I got the seventh book when I had two children under the age of three and finished it in less than 3 days. And that was over 800 pages.
You know, this was before Netflix and all that binge watching.
Right.
This was binge reading. This really started that trend of binge reading.
I think it really did. I remember being in the carpool line and listening to, remember Daniel Pinkwater on, he was on NPR. I think he was talking with Terry Gross or something like that. And he was talking about this new book that came out of England. And I thought it was about someone named Daniel Potter. I couldn't remember or Motter. I wasn't sure what it was, but I called a friend of mine whose daughter now works at Hachette. And I said, you've got to get this book for your daughter, Luria, because she was a huge reader. And then I went and bought the book and I was hooked myself. And I thought, you know what? This is a winner. There is something so incredibly universal about JK, about Joanne or the Queen Mum of the written word. I think that all the Potter books should be required reading.
Desiree, I want to talk about, you mentioned that you were having midnight parties and there were lines at the store and down the street. You have a big celebration coming up to mark the 20th anniversary.
July 31st is Harry Potter's birthday. We've chosen to go ahead and celebrate the 20th anniversary of the release of the books. And so from 5 to 8 p.m. on Tuesday, July 31st, we'll have a variety of activities.
It's going to be great. We can't wait to have everyone come down to the store and join us.
All right, ladies, that's the music bringing us out.
All right.
Take this, everybody. We'll be right back.
Wonderful.
Community Hospice and Palliative Care. Since 1979, the compassionate guide for more than 200,000 patients facing advanced illness in Northeast Florida. Today, serving 16 counties, including yours, available 24/7 to help you and your loved one. More at choosecommunityhospice.com.
ViStar Credit Union, focused on offering choices in checking, savings, and certificates to its members while remaining financially strong since 1952. ViStar, we never forget that it's your money. Information 777-6000 or vistarcu.org.
On the next Fresh Air, how the country's largest providers of psychiatric care are not hospitals, but rather the jails in Chicago, Los Angeles, and New York City. We'll hear from journalist Elisa Roth, who visited jails across the country for her new book, Insane, about how the mentally ill often end up in correctional facilities ill-equipped to treat them. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
The Trump administration has set up a new task force with 12 new lawyers. They're reviewing the records of thousands of immigrants who've become naturalized citizens.
There's a fear that if the government has a program that's up and running looking for people to denaturalize, one could fear that they would pursue people they didn't like.
Alarm over the government's new denaturalization campaign on The World.
This afternoon at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
What does the Trump administration have against breastfeeding? The United States shocked the world by opposing an international resolution advocating mother's milk as healthiest for babies. American officials said that women should not feel stigmatized if they choose not to breastfeed. What's going on? Next time on 1A. Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back, everyone. Finally, this hour is a musical that was inspired by a Disney movie, but really it was inspired by real life events. We can't forget that. Newsies tells the story of a strike by newspaper boys in 1899 in New York City. The musical is the latest Apex Theater production coming to the Ponte Vedra Concert Hall, a great venue. To talk about it is joining us Apex Theater Executive Director Ian Mayers. Ian, always lovely to see you.
Good morning.
Plus two, just try to show me up with your radio voice. Plus two of the stars of the show who play the romantic leads, Jack and Catherine. We have Rebecca Carroll. She's a sophomore at Texas Christian University. Hello.
Hi.
And a Kansas City native, Antoni Lalonde.
Hi.
A New York-based actor and recent grad of the New York Film Academy and
yes.
Native of like you were destined for great things with that name, Tony Lalonde.
Oh, thank you.
But yeah, I want to start with, you know, I kind of mentioned a little bit, it was a book, it was a movie, but it's inspired by real life, very dramatic, life-changing events, because back in the day, newspapers were sold mostly by children who lived on the streets or were orphans.
Exactly. Right. And this is just one of those fabulous stories where you just root for this group of young kids the minute you meet them. And, you know, I think the Disney movie with a very young Christian Bale had its own cult following and it built.
Totally.
And so it then turned into a Broadway musical that also has had an insane cult following.
Yeah.
But it's great. And it's been great spending time with the young actors and trying to get them to understand that we used to just get our news from the newspaper.
and they used to make the kids who were orphans buy the newspapers.
Exactly.
And then the kids had to go then sell it in order to get their money back and make a profit. And the impetus was really that the newspapers started to charge the kids more.
Exactly.
So they could make money off
exactly.
the kids.
Exactly. And this group of young children rose up against Joseph Pulitzer
and
went on strike.
Can you believe that? Now, is it true that, and when I was reading the little background, that the Catherine character was really a Pulitzer. She was the daughter.
Yeah,
yeah right. She's Pulitzer's daughter.
So let's talk a little bit. Let's bring the Catherine story in, because I think she plays such a great role in
this. And it's a great role for a young leading actress.
Oh, yeah. It's an amazing role to have the opportunity to play so young, I think, too. It's something that I never knew if I would play. But Catherine, basically, the first time we see her is a short interaction with Jack, and she's kind of, he's flirting with her, but she's, you know, she's on a mission. She's a reporter. She's out there just trying to cover the news. She's like, I don't care about this. I don't care about anything he has to say.
But she's a young girl reporter, which was rare at the time,
trying to make
a name for herself. So she's on the hunt for a good scoop.
Yeah. And then she gets wrapped up in the story with these boys, and she's like, this is something. She's tired of doing entertainment news because that's what they give her because she's a girl. And she's like, I can make a real story out of this. And also, these boys, I'm rooting for them. I want them to succeed, even though it's against my father. and against, you know, everything I was raised to believe.
Oh, come on. Every young girl wants to revolt against her parents.
Absolutely. It's her version of a tattoo.
Exactly.
You know what I'm saying?
And Jack's kind of the leader of the movement, but, you know, he's interested in Catherine because she's adorable and gorgeous and talented. Yeah. And in this version, sings fabulously.
Oh, yes. She got some pipes.
But he doesn't even, I don't think, realize the opportunity that she presents to him to tell the story.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, she comes in and he's like, "Oh, a pretty girl."
Yeah. And,
you know,
what? Get my movement out there? No, pretty girl.
Right, exactly. Right. But he's like the big brother to all these kids, and it's just a great character. He's such a role model for these boys. Yeah. And he's, like I said, he's such a brother role, but he definitely misses his opportunity to get that story out. And he's just so focused on Catherine.
And this role is really an interesting role for Tony, because Tony was slated to become a professional baseball player.
Right.
Yeah. And saw this production of Newsies in New York on Broadway. And you can tell Tony it changed his life.
Yeah, yeah. I saw this production on Broadway in 2014. And I was supposed to go play baseball and pitch and, you know, have that path. And then I saw this, and 6 minutes into the show, I was like, oh, this is a possibility for a career? Absolutely.
Okay, but wait, the possibility means you must sing and dance and act, not just pitch a ball. Exactly. So did you already know going into it that you had those skill sets? Or did you say, let me go home, sing in the shower, see what I got?
Well, I was doing theater in high school since seventh grade.
Okay.
And I mean, just, you know, community high school, nothing crazy. And I was like, oh, I have to at least try this. If I don't try, I'll regret it for the rest of my life. So I immediately made that choice. So I was like, oh, I have to do this. And, you know, the rest is history. I moved to New York like 2 weeks after I graduated high school. And
amazing.
Yep. Just started school and went to a conservatory. And yeah.
Now, it says you're the recent grad of the New York Film Academy, but you are on stage. You are on theater now.
Right. It's a conservatory program. And in the first 2 years, the first year is just theater. And if you do the second year, it's musical theater on film. So they write a original movie musical for you, and you get to perform in that, and they give you like on stage classes as well as behind the camera, on camera, voiceover, all this stuff. It's really the whole package.
What a great, interesting story for folks out there who are listening and who may have a young person who's interested in this. Now, we have to talk real quick about the arc of the story, because there becomes conflict between Catherine and Jack, because can I give too much away?
Well, I mean, you know, he figures out who she is.
Yeah.
Right? There's
a
reveal.
She's the enemy in a way.
Yeah.
So that's the turn, you know. But, you know, love prevails because it's Disney.
Because it's Disney.
Disney love story.
So it does. And in the meantime, you know, you've fallen in love with this whole group of ragtag newsboys played by kids from all over this area, as well as our visiting young artists from 10 colleges across America, some of the top musical theater programs in the country, who are guest artisting with us.
Well, thank you all so much for being here. What a great way to end the show.
Thank you.
Please go check them out. They are at the Pontevedra Music Hall. That's such a wonderful place to see the venue. Mm-hmm. So intimate. That's going to be it for us today. Gosh, it always goes by so fast. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mearshart. Michelle Korm does a wonderful job of keeping me on track by running the board. The show's theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Next on 1A, the future of Roe versus Wade with a Kennedy Les Scotus. Everybody's been talking about it. You're going to learn more. I'm sure Charlene Shirk in for Melissa Ross. You're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT Jacksonville.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.